You've been listening to KBOO News In Depth. I'm Althea Billings. Thanks for being with us.
This is Cesar Chavez. You're listening to KBOO, listener-sponsored radio.
I'm Sequoia Ezekwe for Ear to the Streets of Portland on the best community radio station on the planet, KBOO Community Radio, KBOO Portland.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available at our website at kboo.fm. The Development and Events Committee meets on the third Monday of the month at 5:30 p.m. This month's meeting will be held online through a public video conference. A public link and phone number to attend the meeting can be found on our website at kboo.fm. Please visit our website to verify if a meeting is being held.
You're listening to KBOO's All Thrills, No Frills, Volume 4 Special Programming Campaign. Check out all the great special programs we're bringing you now through April 15th at kboo.fm/ATNF4.
Even though we're living in such different political climates and like just different cultural times, I think there's so many things that we can look back on and take inspiration from on how to organize now and how to like find our community and surround ourselves with our supportive community now. I want to be living proof to younger trans people that like you can be trans and love being trans and be proud of it and have joy in your life and find community that also like centers that joy.
Welcome to This Way Out, the international LGBTQ radio magazine. I'm Brian DeShazer. Two young men in Indonesia to be flogged for gay sex. A UK appeals court nixes a non-binary gender marker. And building a joyful transmasculine community. Those stories and more this week because you found This Way Out.
I'm Ava Davis.
And I'm Joe Bainline.
With NewsWrap. A summary of some of the news in or affecting LGBTQ communities around the world for the week ending March 1st, 2025. Two young men in the Indonesian province of Aceh are to be publicly beaten with a cane for having gay sex. They were arrested on November 7th after anti-queer vigilantes broke into their rented room and discovered them naked and hugging each other. Under Islamic law, they were tried for morality offenses. The 18 and 24-year-old college students were sentenced to 80 and 85 lashes, respectively. Sakwana is the single name of the judge overseeing the trial. That's a custom for many Indonesians. Her ruling found, during the trial, it was proven that the defendants committed illicit acts, including kissing and having sex. While the maximum penalty is 100 lashings in public and up to 8 years in prison, Sakwana lessened the sentences because neither had a police record, both were polite in court, and they are otherwise considered to be outstanding students. The older of the two will be flogged the most. The pair accepted their sentences without appeal. Sharia has been the law in Aceh province since a 2006 dispute with federal authorities allowed it to adopt Islamic legal practice. The rest of Indonesia is governed by secular laws. More than 100 people each year in the province have been publicly caned for various morality offenses. The scheduled public caning in Aceh comes on the heels of last week's raid on what authorities called a gay sex party in Jakarta. 56 men were arrested in a private hotel room and charged with violating the country's secular laws against obscenity and pornography.
British law does not recognize non-binary as a gender, according to the United Kingdom Court of Appeal. Cybersecurity expert Ryan Castellucci moved from Los Angeles in 2019. They obtained legal recognition as non-binary in California in 2021 and were issued a U.S. passport listing their gender as X the following year. They tried to have their gender recorded as non-binary on a U.K. gender recognition certificate, a document which changes someone's legal sex. They lost the bid in an earlier high court challenge. Meanwhile, a Trump administration executive order has eliminated the X gender passport option. Lord Justice Singh deferred to Parliament in dismissing the appeal, saying that the UK's two-gender policy was up to lawmakers to address, not the judiciary. Castellucci called their efforts to be legally recognized as non-binary an ordeal, but their lawyers say they are considering a further appeal. At 30-something, they're looking ahead saying, I plan to live the rest of my life here and eventually die here. Being denied the dignity of knowing my death certificate will be correct makes my stomach turn.
Iowa's transgender people are no longer protected from discrimination. Republican Governor Kim Reynolds has signed a bill that revokes the addition of gender identity to the Iowa Civil Rights Act in 2007. Thus, the current Republican-dominated state legislature has undone the statute by the previous Democratic administration and affirmed by the state Supreme Court in 2022. Hundreds of people rallied at the state capitol building to protest the bill's imminent passage.
We are trans like we're together, and we are singing for our
Iowa's legislature ignored the voices of the people. The Republicans argued that revoking gender identity protections in civil rights laws will make it easier for the state to defend its other anti-trans laws, such as the ban on trans student competitors in female sports. That's already being challenged in court. Iowa is now the first state in U.S. history to excise a class originally granted civil rights protection. Max Mowitz of queer advocacy group One Iowa told the Des Moines Register, "This law will cause real harm, making daily life harder and more uncertain for countless Iowans who simply want to live openly and authentically. History will not look kindly on this moment."
Two executive orders by U.S. President Donald Trump that threaten the civil rights of LGBTQ people and other U.S. citizens are already being roadblocked in court. Maryland-based U.S. District Judge Adam B. Abelson said that the key provisions targeting federal agencies and federal-funded diversity, equity, and inclusion programs in higher education and the private sector were impermissibly vague and threatened to chill constitutionally protected speech and activity. Abelson issued a preliminary injunction this week blocking their enforcement. The ruling noted that the administration's effort to uproot DEI programs failed to define key terms, such as equity-related and illegal DEI. Abelson was not convinced that the order was necessary to root out illegal discrimination. This challenge is being led by national education groups and the city of Baltimore. At least one other lawsuit against the anti-diversity order has been filed by Lambda Legal and the Legal Defense Fund on behalf of the National Urban League, the National Fair Housing Alliance, and AIDS Foundation Chicago.
The block on a second Trump order is keeping transgender women in U.S. women's prisons from being transferred to men's prisons. That action was to comply with the Trump decree that U.S. law recognizes only two genders, male and female. Washington, D.C.-based U.S. District Judge Royce Lamberth ruled that the move would violate trans women's constitutional rights and put them in jeopardy of serious harm. Lamberth had previously issued an order to protect three trans women inmates from imminent transfer. The latest ruling expands that protection to nine additional plaintiffs who were rounded up by Bureau of Prison officials and told they would be immediately transferred to men's prisons, according to court filings. The Trump order also terminates current gender-affirming health care for trans inmates. The judge believes the lawsuit challenging the Trump anti-trans order is likely to be overturned on Eighth Amendment protections against imposing excessive bail, excessive fines, or cruel and unusual punishments. Judge Lamberth questioned the Trump administration's motives. He wrote that the order would exacerbate the symptoms of their gender dysphoria, even if they are not subject to physical or sexual violence in their new facility, whether because they will be subject to searches by male correctional officers, made to shower in the company of men, referred to as men.
The U.S. Supreme Court is letting Tennessee's virtual ban on drag performances stand. On February 24th, it decided not to hear a case challenging the law. The legislation was enacted by the Republican-controlled state in 2023. It was ruled unconstitutionally vague and substantially overbroad by a judge on the U.S. District Court for the Western District of Tennessee. However, last July, the 6th U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals reversed the decision on a technicality. The top court has now let stand its finding that the complainant, Friends of George Incorporated Drag Theater Company of Memphis, lacked the legal standing to sue. Another lawsuit challenging Tennessee's drag ban is still working its way through the U.S. judicial system. The American Civil Liberties Union filed suit on behalf of Blount County Pride organizers because the law threatened prosecution of any violators during its 2023 Pride Festival.
Finally, however, there was one hearing the U.S. High Court did hold this week. The reverse discrimination case of a straight, white, cisgender woman who claims that she was denied a promotion and demoted after allegedly less qualified queer colleagues gained positions ahead of her. 60-year-old Marlene Ames worked for years for the Ohio Department of Youth Services, the state's juvenile justice system. A lower appeals court ruled in her case that a so-called majority group plaintiff must meet a higher evidentiary standard than plaintiffs in other bias cases. In other words, it's harder for heterosexual workers to prove discrimination based on sexual orientation or for white employees claiming racial bias. The Supreme Court is expected to issue its ruling before the current term ends in late June. A number of civil rights groups are deeply concerned that a win for Ames could open a Pandora's box of countless reverse discrimination cases, and that could be especially dangerous in the current climate against diversity, equity, and inclusion.
That's News Wrap, global queer news with attitude for the week ending March 1st, 2025. Follow the news in your area and around the world. An informed community is a strong community.
News Wrap is written by Greg Gordon and Lucia Chappell, produced by Brian Shazor, and brought to you by you.
Thank you. Help keep us in ears around the world at thiswayout.org. where you can also read the text of this newscast and much more. For This Way Out, I'm Joe Bainline. Stay healthy.
And I'm Ava Davis. Stay safe.
Our listeners support This Way Out in many ways.
By subscribing to our e-newsletter.
Email us at info@thiswayout.org.
And through your financial contributions to our program.
More information about how you can give is online at thiswayout.org.
Thank you.
There's a giant eraser moving across the USA, and the letters T and Q are disappearing from the government's LGBTQ-related websites and publications. The Trump administration has even wiped any mention of transgender people from the signage outside the Stonewall National Monument, despite the fact that it was trans activists who launched the 1969 rebellion it memorializes. While conservative politicians are using their network of far-right media outlets to power the transphobic purge, This Way Out's David Hunt met one New York college student who's focused on a new kind of narrative, the history and the joy of transmasculine community building.
In an open letter to the academic community in the summer of 2009, scholar Eve Tuck urged educators to reconsider the impact of what she called damage-centered research, work that focuses on people's pain and brokenness to hold those in power accountable for their oppression. It may be well-intentioned, she wrote, but this type of research reinforces and reinscribes a one-dimensional notion of people as depleted, ruined, and hopeless. Instead, she said, academics should seek to understand the complexity, contradiction, and self-determination of the people they study. Focus on their desires, not their damage, she said. As Tuck wrote those words, seated at a little table in her Hudson Valley, New York home, a young tomboy in rural Pennsylvania looked up at the night sky, caught a glimpse of a shooting star, and made a wish. I hope I wake up
tomorrow and I'm a boy.
I'm David Hunt. Eli Butler's wish did come true, eventually. The Pennsylvania tomboy is now a 22-year-old transgender man, living in New York City, and conducting academic research of his own. Research centered on the joy of being transmasculine. Research influenced by the scholarship of Eve Tuck, and inspired by the transmasculine activists who paved his way. I no longer want damage to be the focus of research about trans communities, Butler said in his senior thesis for a degree in peace and justice studies. I want to shift the research narrative toward possibility. I sat down with Butler to discuss his life, his research, and the possibilities of the future.
I love being trans. Like, I've enjoyed this journey. I think that life is like, and for everybody is just kind of learning more about yourself every day and like making changes in your life that accompany that. So I'm like still figuring out who I am as a trans person every day.
That's not to say the Pace University undergraduate's life is free from oppression. On the day we talked, the National Park Service was busy rewriting history, erasing the story of the transgender activists who led the 1969 protests at the Stonewall Inn, what is now the Stonewall National Monument, less than 2 miles from the Pace University campus in New York. But the Trump administration's efforts to legally extinguish the visibility, even the very existence, of transgender people has galvanized the community. More than 1,000 protesters rallied at the historic site on February 14th to decry the Park Service's erasure of trans history. It seemed fitting that this demonstration of loud and proud queer community should happen while Butler and I discussed the focus of his senior thesis, community building by transmasculine people, past and present. In researching his thesis at the New York Public Library and in archives of transgender publications and organizations, Butler discovered that transmasculine community building has a rich and layered history going back generations.
I think that, like, a lot of times we think that trans people were all underground until the 2000s or until the late 90s. But that was not the case. And reading these newsletters was like, wow, they've been telling us that we haven't existed until now. Like, we have existed and been loud about it for decades now.
The literature review section of Butler's thesis is a history lesson, chronicling the contributions of trans men who are largely unknown and unappreciated today, including Steve Dane, who made headlines in the late 1970s after transitioning and being fired from his job as a public high school teacher, and Mario Martino, who established a counseling service for trans men called Labyrinth in 1968.
It was really heartwarming to me to see the ways that different trans guys talked about themselves and talked about the other trans guys that they were with, how similar it was to experiences that I've had and other people had. I just think there's so many similarities, even though we're living in such different political climates and like just different cultural times. I think there's so many things that we can look back on and take inspiration from on how to organize now and how to like find our community and surround ourselves with our supportive community now.
To learn more about community building by trans masculine men today, Butler interviewed 3 trans men, a licensed therapist in a southern state who facilitates a virtual trans masculine support group, the leader of the Louisville Trans Masculine Alliance in Kentucky, and a counselor for the Virginia Tech chapter of Delta Lambda Phi, a fraternity for gay, bisexual, transgender, and progressive men. Among Butler's findings, masculinity can be problematic.
I see a lot of stuff online from people who are like, you're going to the dark side, like when you're transitioning into a masculine identity. And so I think a lot of masculine people like feel discouraged by that, and they want to be around people who also see masculinity more in a more positive light.
Butler found that community building evolved as a survival tactic to create spaces of support and understanding among an astoundingly underrepresented and isolated group. And he demonstrated that community building is affected by differences in geography and organizing styles.
I mean, there are similarities between all of the groups for sure, but you know, based on the different focuses of these groups, you're having different community building experiences. So like one of these was this like trans masculine frat. And so, you know, building community in a frat is so much different than building community in a support group. Like you're talking about different things, you're focusing on different things, but there is like this general relation between everybody. Even these groups that are so different in how they go about building community, they are talking about and focusing on similar things. They're just going about it in different ways.
A nearly universal advantage of community building, Butler found, is its role in healing trauma. Trauma isolates. The group recreates a sense of belonging, Butler explained, referencing the work of American psychiatrist Judith Lewis Herman.
I read a lot of books from therapists and psychiatrists about how building community heals trauma, which I think is is especially important in the trans community, which even if you're a trans person that hasn't experienced any kind of personal transphobia, you know, you're living in this society which is just violently transphobic. So building community like allows you to heal those wounds in a certain way. You're now in a place where people understand you. They understand your trauma. Maybe they've been through similar things, or in the broader way, they understand exactly the feelings that you're feeling, and you can process that trauma together. And that is the healing power of community.
You're listening to This Way Out, the international LGBTQ radio magazine. I'm David Hunt, continuing my conversation with Eli Butler about his research into transmasculine community building. Butler's academic work is informed by his personal journey as a transgender man. That journey began at an early age.
I actually realized I was trans when I was in the fourth grade. I think I was around 8 years old. I changed my name. I went through like kind of a social transition, which is kind of the most that a lot of younger kids can do. I wore, you know, more masculine clothing. I went by a different name. I went by different pronouns. That was so against the status quo. Not that like being trans isn't against the status quo already, but you know, for someone so young. And so I was kind of like, I want to say forced out of that, or like kind of pressure was put on me to grow out of that. And so I went back to living as a woman and identifying as a woman until around COVID. And COVID was really the time when I had time to sit with myself. And I feel like this happened to a lot of people. It was like the first time you were forced to be alone with your thoughts and really like reflect on how you see yourself, how you see the world. And that's when I realized that I was non-binary. And then when I finally came to college, I realized that I was more binary masculine than I thought I was at first.
But even in New York, a metropolis with one of the world's largest LGBTQ populations, Butler discovered that something was missing in his life.
I mean, I think of New York in terms of like the gay revolution of the 70s, expecting it to be like full of activities and clubs and groups of people that just like were so like out and proud about their queerness or their transness. And I came to New York and to a liberal arts college thinking that's how it would be. I would find my people who understood me and it would just be so easy. And it was not. And I actually found a lack of transmasculine, specifically groups in New York City.
It was that experience, the longing for community, that led Butler to focus his senior thesis on transmasculine community building. In doing that, he discovered the challenges, as well as the joys, of creating change.
One of my interviewees said something that really struck me, and this is how I think of how strengthening community needs to be now, which is that community is a two-way street. You're not just coming to the community or trying to find a community when you need help. You're there all the time. You're there to support people when they need help, and then so that when you need help, you can come to them.
Now that his senior thesis is done, Butler has the time to focus on some community building of his own. He's spearheading a project to create a quilt of trans joy, a project inspired by the Norfolk Trans Joy Community Quilt, a project led by partners Bo Brannick and Alice Bigsby Bye in the United Kingdom.
I am holding workshops where trans people, trans students can come in and, you know, their allies, their loved ones, or their friends can come in, make a quilt square. Then it's going to be this big quilt of like trans joy. And it's going to be put up in the LGBTQ center at the school and whatnot. So it's like, it's half this like community building and art focused kind of project. And it's also half like a political resistance kind of message.
At the end of the day, Butler explained, building community is about finding your people and finding your joy.
I can't imagine being a young trans person right now, looking at the news and being like, wow, like my identity is all based in suffering, because that's a lot of times what it seems like. I've had younger trans people like in my life say this to me, where they're like, you seem like you like being trans. Like, can you tell me that it gets better? I like want to be living proof to younger trans people that like you can be trans and love being trans and be proud of it and have joy in your life and find community that also like centers that joy.
I'd like to thank Eli Butler for sharing his story for this program. For This Way Out, I'm David Hunt.
Thanks for choosing This Way Out, brought to you by the nonprofit Overnight Productions. NewsWrap was reported this week by Ava Davis and Joe Bayline, and produced by Brian DeShazer. David Hunt produced this week's feature. Seals and Croft, T. Ricky, J. Patrick Lemieux, and Michael Shines performed some of the music you heard, and Kim Wilson composed and performed our theme music. This Way Out thanks Hal Myers of Santa Fe, New Mexico, and Richard Merck and Brad Payton of Silicon Valley. Listener donors make this program possible. Ask us about how you can join them. Look for This Way Out Radio on social media, email us at info@thiswayout.org, or write us at P.O. Box 1065, Los Angeles, California, 90078, USA. For coordinating producer Greg Gordon, associate producer Lucia Chappell, and the entire This Way Out crew, I'm Brian DeShazer. Thanks for listening. Online at thiswayout.org or wherever you get your podcasts. And on KRZA, Alamosa, Colorado, WCRX, Chicago, Illinois, CJLY, Nelson Crawford Bay, New Denver, British Columbia, and a wide array of community, terrestrial, and internet radio stations around the world, including this one. Stay healthy, stay safe, and stay tuned.
This is Dr. Caldicott talking on 90.7 FM KBOO. You all realize how terribly important this radio station is now that the federal government is trying to cut funds for national public radio. And you all realize that the real truth only comes out of public radio, and that all the rest of the media is compromised and represents the corporations who are destroying the earth. So you absolutely have to support KBOO with lots of money now. It's imperative, and you all know that.
People are reporting physical assaults, death threats, being called anti-gay names, and reporting property damage that is anti-gay related.
The Scottish Executive is committed very strongly to repealing Section 28, and repeal is supported by three of the four main parties in the Scottish Parliament.
A vote on the Civil Unions Bill is expected later this month. If the bill passes both Vermont's House and Senate, the Governor has said he will sign it.
Welcome to This Way Out, the international LGBTQ radio magazine. I'm Lucia Chappell. Ghana's controversial anti-queer bill rises from the dead. Germany warns trans and non-binary travelers away from the U.S. and troubling signs on the road to repression. Those stories and more this week, because you've chosen This Way Out.
I'm David Hunt.
And I'm Melanie Keller.
With NewsWrap, a summary of some of the news in or affecting LGBTQ communities around the world for the week ending March 8, 2025. Ghana's horrific anti-queer bill is rising from the grave. President John Dramani Mahama declared the bill effectively dead shortly after his January inauguration. His predecessor, President Nana Akufo-Addo, had refused to sign the Promotion of Proper Human Sexual Rights and Ghanaian Family Values until the Supreme Court verified its legality. That ruling is still pending. Mahama generally supports the legislation, but says he'd prefer the measure to come from his government rather than as a bill introduced by members of parliament. Nevertheless, 10 members did that this week with the strong backing of the country's leading religious figures, according to Reuters. What's called under the law unnatural carnal knowledge can already get you up to 3 years in prison in Ghana. The new bill increases that maximum to 5 years for private consensual adult same-gender sex. Here's the really alarming part. It calls for up to 5 years in prison for the willful promotion, sponsorship, or support of LGBTQ plus activities. Make that up to 10 years if the advocacy is aimed at minors. There's no gender-affirming healthcare in the West African nation. In fact, transgender people are not recognized. LGBTQ people have basically no legal protections. It's not clear if President Mahama would sign the new bill if it passes parliamentary muster. Last year, Ghana's finance ministry warned that it could tank billions of dollars in critical funding from the World Bank, the International Monetary Fund, and from Western nations. And remember, everyone is still waiting for a Supreme Court ruling about the previous bill's legality.
Germany's government is cautioning its transgender and non-binary citizens about traveling to the United States. It's a clear reaction to the Trump administration's declaration that only two genders are legally recognized in the United States. Germany's Foreign Office advisory says that citizens seeking temporary visas must declare themselves to either be male or female to get into the United States. It further warned, travelers who have the gender entry X or whose current gender entry differs from their gender entry at birth should contact the relevant U.S. diplomatic mission in Germany before entering the country and find out the applicable entry requirements. U.S. Secretary of State Marco Rubio has officially eliminated the X gender option on passports. The American Civil Liberties Union is currently suing the State Department on behalf of 7 plaintiffs challenging the new male or female-only passport policy. Rubio's late February memo obtained by The Guardian tells immigration officials around the world, in cases where applicants are suspected of misrepresenting their purpose of travel or sex, you should consider whether this misrepresentation is material such that it supports an ineligibility finding. That so-called misrepresentation includes declaring a gender that differs from their birth sex on visa applications. It could mean a permanent ban on entering the U.S. The Department of Homeland Security is also targeting transgender athletes. Right before this year's World Pride in Washington, D.C., and ahead of the 2028 Olympics in Los Angeles. Critics fear that the directive will ultimately be used to ban all foreign transgender and non-binary people from entering the United States.
$8 million to promote LGBTQI+ in the African nation of Lesotho, which nobody has ever heard of.
U.S. President Donald Trump's State of the Union address was a record-setting, almost two-hour marathon of lies and bizarre claims. Lesotho's leading queer advocacy group was dismayed by Trump's accusation. The People's Matrix spokesperson, Tamposa Motapang, told Agence France-Presse, "We are literally not receiving grants from the U.S. We have no idea of the allocation of $8 million. We do not know who received or is going to receive that money. We do not have such monies or a contract that would even reach a quarter of half of that money." Lesotho's government is not taking this matter lightly, according to Foreign Minister Lejeune Mpojine. He told the French news agency, "We did not expect a head of state to refer to another sovereign nation in such a manner." An official letter of protest will be delivered to the Oval Office, which Lesotho has heard of.
$8 million for making mice transgender. This is real.
Well, no, it's not. This eyebrow-raising claim during Trump's State of the Union address again demonstrated the incompetence of the administration's effort to slash allegedly wasteful spending. In their zeal to erase transgender people from government policy, they targeted a government-funded study involving transgenic mice. Put simply, a transgenic mouse's genes have been modified to better reflect how human tissue reacts. They are invaluable in biomedical research. CNN fact-checkers
found three National Institutes of Health awards totaling less than $500,000 that involved giving feminizing hormones to monkeys to understand their impact on susceptibility to HIV. Nothing about mice at all.
Trump crowed about all his anti-trans executive orders and also targeted diversity, equity, and inclusion programs, DEI, derisively describing such efforts as wokeness.
We're getting wokeness out of our schools and out of our military, and it's already out, and it's out of our society. We don't want it. Wokeness is trouble. Wokeness is bad. It's gone. It's gone. And we feel so much better for it, don't we? Don't we feel better?
Do we?
On the positive side, President Trump's anti-trans efforts were dealt a serious setback in the U.S. Senate this week. Every Democrat voted against the Republican-sponsored Protection of Women and Girls in Sports Act. The measure intends to ban trans women and girls from competing in federally funded school and college female sports. Trump's executive order to accomplish the same goal is already being challenged in court. The bill was stopped by a cloture vote. That's a procedural motion in the Senate that requires 60 votes to end debate and move forward. The final tally fell 9 votes short. It had sailed through the Republican-controlled U.S. House in January, but has now died in the upper chamber. Democratic Senator John Hickenlooper of Colorado accused clueless lead sponsor of the bill, Republican Senator Tommy Tuberville of Alabama, of trying to churn the social wars. The Human Rights Campaign's Kelly Robinson said, "Bills like these send the message that transgender kids don't deserve the same opportunities to thrive as their peers simply because of who they are."
Finally, more than 11,000 people marched, danced, or rolled down Oxford Street through the queer Darlinghurst neighborhood in Sydney for the Australian city's 47th annual Gay and Lesbian Mardi Gras Parade. An estimated 200,000 spectators were there to cheer them on. The traditional Dykes on Bikes parade leaders were followed by the First Nations and first Mardi Gras participant entries. Celebrating the theme Free to Be, people in several parade entries carried signs reading Protect Trans Kids. The nighttime festivities featured more than 180 floats and marching units from community service groups, local businesses, and major corporations. Prime Minister Anthony Albanese, Sydney Lord Mayor Clover Moore, and Environment Minister Tanya Plibersek were among the public officials to join the procession. More than 10,000 people were expected to party until dawn at the marquee 8-hour Mardi Gras party rave at Moore Park. The official closing party capped the 16-day Mardi Gras festival the following night. This Way Out Sydney correspondent Barry McKay speculates that political statements were somewhat muted during the parade because of recent Israeli-Palestinian unrest. The most out there contingent, he reports, came thanks to Vice President J.D. Vance and the unrest in the U.S., a marching band of lesbian, childless cat ladies.
That's News Wrap, global queer news with attitude for the week ending March 8th, 2025. Follow the news in your area and around the world. An informed community is a strong community.
News Wrap is written by Greg Gordon and Lucia Chappell, produced by Brian DeShazer, and brought to you by you.
Thank you. Help keep us in ears around the world at thiswayout.org, where you can also read the text of this newscast and much more. For This Way Out, I'm Melanie Keller. Stay healthy.
And I'm David Hunt. Stay safe.
Our listeners support This Way Out in many ways.
By subscribing to our e-newsletter.
Email us at info@thiswayout.org.
And through your financial contributions to our program.
More information about how you can give is online at thiswayout.org.
Thank you.
Painted pony.
spinning wheel spin.
In the cycle between LGBTQ plus inclusion and exile, you can see the same signposts in either direction. The pattern seems to be the same from country to country, culture to culture. Whether the queer community is on the rise or whether rights are being extinguished step by step, three of the key landmarking issues are what you say, how you serve, and who you marry.
Just don't say gay.
Gay, gay, gay. Gay, 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 gay.
Just don't say gay. Gay,
gay, gay, gay. Gay, 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 gay.
Just don't say gay.
The state of Florida passed its Don't Say Gay restrictions on what could be said in schools about LGBTQ plus life and history in 2022. It was a sign to many that a 21st century wave of repression was at hand. Of course, Russia's long-standing law against the so-called promotion of homosexuality has been a model for illiberal countries like Hungary. Ghana's controversial bill that was reintroduced in Parliament this week calls for 5 years jail time for the willful promotion, sponsorship, or support of LGBTQ plus activities, 10 years if minors are involved. However, it was conservatives in the UK who put through the first bill to give the world the expression no promo homo. In reaction to the AIDS crisis, part of the Local Government Act of 1988, titled Section 28, said that schools shall not intentionally promote homosexuality or publish material with the intention of promoting homosexuality, and could not promote the teaching of the acceptability of homosexuality as a pretended family relationship. Activists fought almost two decades for the repeal of Section 28 and had high hopes when New Labour took control of the government. A devolving Scotland was beating them to repeal when This Way Out's Julie Carver spoke with Tim Hopkins of the Equality Network in March of 2000.
The Labour government in Britain, which was elected 2.5 years ago, has said ever since it was elected that it would repeal Section 28 when the opportunity arose. And in fact, we now have a devolved government and parliament in Scotland, so it's being done separately in Scotland from England and Wales.
And I understand that there's a Cardinal Winning who has started a large campaign against the repeal of Section 28. What's all that about?
Well, it might be unfair to say that he's actually started the campaign. He was certainly the first major voice to speak out questioning the repeal of Section 28. There's been more of a problem in Scotland from the British religious right organisations. There's one in particular which kind of models the way it works on some of the religious right groups in the States, and they've been spending a lot of money on campaigning against the repeal of Section 28.
What objection can they have to repealing Section 28? Because this is the thing that prevents a lot of teachers helping gay teenagers who are being bullied in school. I mean, why are they against helping these kids?
I think the answer is that really, the reason they're against repealing it is that they don't like the idea of homosexuality, and they're basically homophobic, anti-gay organizations, so religious conservatives. They try and dress up their objections in practical terms. So they say things like that they're worried that if Section 28 is repealed, teachers in schools will start trying to encourage people to be gay, all sorts of nonsense like that. But luckily, I think those kind of arguments are quite easy to counter by saying, well, you know, there's no heterosexual propaganda and pornography in schools now, so why do you think there's going to be gay pornography when Section 28 is repealed? It's not going to happen. The churches in Scotland are quite split on this issue. There are a lot of church people in Scotland who agree with the repeal of Section 28, so it's only the conservative wing of the churches, and I think people understand that what really lies behind it is their dislike of homosexuality, and some of them quite openly say that we're against repealing Section 28 because we believe that homosexuality is wrong, full stop.
Tim Hopkins of Britain's Equality Network was right 25 years ago. Discrimination based on sexual orientation and gender identity is still born out of hatred and fear, not facts. That could not be more clear as the Trump administration goes full bore, raising the second warning signal of the movement toward the suppression of rights, an attack on how queer people serve in the military. One of the lawsuits fighting the current purge of transgender service members argues that the most recent memorandum proves that the orders are motivated solely by animus. In it, the Pentagon charges that gender dysphoria includes physical and mental health problems and weaknesses in honesty, humility, and integrity that are incompatible with military service. No other mental problems or weaknesses, such as alcoholism or sexual misconduct, could be named. The Defense Department has offered no evidence to back its claims and admits that it does not even know how many active duty trans service members there might be. Activist groups estimate that there are fewer than 2,000 out of 1.3 million. Still, they are being urged to separate themselves from the military by the end of March or face uncertain consequences. A hearing to seek an emergency injunction against the policy is set for March 12th. Rather than foster a more battle-ready military, restrictions on queer service members has led in the past to harassment, abuse, and even death. After President Bill Clinton unsuccessfully attempted to allow LGBTQ plus people to serve openly in the military, the compromise policy known as Don't Ask, Don't Tell was established in 1994. In an interview from March of 2000, C. Dixon Osborne of the Service Members Legal Defense Network described for This Way Out's Frank Stoltz how homophobic harassment had only increased.
We documented 986 specific instances of anti-gay harassment compared to 400 the year before. And what we're finding is people are reporting physical assaults, death threats, being called anti-gay names, and reporting property damage that is anti-gay related. Obviously, the worst incident of anti-gay harassment was the murder of Private First Class Barry Winchell at Fort Campbell, Kentucky this year.
Two fellow soldiers conspired to bash PFC Barry Winchell's head in with a baseball bat while he slept because he was found to be dating a trans woman, Calpurnia Adams. The one who wielded the bat got a life sentence and was paroled in 2020, while the bat's owner, who got him drunk and egged him on, spent only 6 years in jail. Winchell's parents blamed the Don't Ask, Don't Tell policy for not protecting their son. The March 2000 report cited by SLDN's C. Dixon Osborne to Frank Stoltz would bear that out.
The Pentagon is criticizing your report today. It says its own reporting system has not recorded an increase in incidents of harassment.
The Pentagon has no reporting system on incidents of anti-gay harassment. In fact, the Pentagon makes it extremely difficult to report anti-gay harassment. The Pentagon has ordered psychologists, inspectors generals, and others to turn in people who are found out to be gay in the course of reporting anti-gay harassment. Thus, the Pentagon is being disingenuous. What you're finding is that there is both a lack of recourse and a lack of accountability. First, service members have no way to report violations of Don't Ask, Don't Tell, Don't Pursue. They can't stop witch hunts. They can't stop asking. They can't stop harassment that they face. And at the same time, the Pentagon has not in 6 years held a single person accountable for violating the policy.
At the same time, I've heard some say that it's important to note that overall, it is better to be gay in the military today than, say, it was 10 years ago. Do you agree with that assessment?
Our clients who've been in both before this policy and during this policy say that it is as bad, if not worse. I think it's important for Americans to realize that the same ban on open gay service members exists today as it did before. The same basis for discharge exists. In effect, it is illegal to come out. There is no other federal, state, or local law like that in the country. And what we have is that the Pentagon is firing three people a day for being gay, which is a 73% increase over what it was when the policy was first implemented, and still the highest in a decade.
C. Dixon Osborne's Service Members Legal Defense Network is now the Modern Military Association of America.
How the world can change. It can change like that due to one little word, married.
The third warning signal that LGBTQ plus rights could be in danger was posed by Supreme Court Justice Clarence Thomas when he hinted that who you have the right to marry may deserve another look. Concurring with the overturning of the abortion rights Roe decision, he said that the Obergefell marriage equality ruling could also be subject to review. Since the Respect for Marriage Act signed by President Joe Biden only ensures that states must recognize the marriages performed in other jurisdictions, the overturning of Obergefell would throw marriage equality back to the individual states. That would lead to a state-by-state drama like the one Heather Zerlock reported on in March of 2000.
Early last month, a Vermont House Judiciary Committee overwhelmingly passed a bill that would establish gay domestic partnerships. The legislature was ordered to take up the issue of same-sex marriage following a Vermont Supreme Court decision last year. The court had ruled that Vermont's marriage laws discriminate against gay and lesbian couples and ordered them changed. Lois Farnham and her partner of 27 years, Holly Puderbaugh, were among the couples that had filed the challenge against the state. Farnham says they went to court to win the same rights as married couples, such as power of attorney.
Our power of attorney, that ends at death. So that if something should happen to me or Holly, and even though everybody says right now that everything's hunky-dory, one of our family members could choose against our present wishes as far as funeral and burial.
If the proposed measure is passed, Vermont would be the first state to allow same-sex couples to share health care and pension benefits, to inherit property without a will, and other rights guaranteed to married spouses. But it also falls short of giving gay and lesbian partnerships the same status as traditional marriages. Representative George Chavone heads the Caucus for Traditional Marriage, a group of Vermont legislators opposed to gay and lesbian unions. Chavone says the proposed measure is a compromise that meets the requirements of the state Supreme Court without officially sanctioning gay marriage. And although Chavone is considering supporting the bill, he would like to see more provisions in it that protect traditional marriages.
Being very honest, we probably, if this had never come from the Supreme Court, we probably wouldn't be in this point of doing this. But since we did get through the Supreme Court, we did get their opinion, we believe that this is a more fair way to do it for Vermonters.
Michael Adams is the Associate Director of the American Civil Liberty Union's Gay and Lesbian Rights Project. Adams praised the bill, but says he'd like to see it amended to give gay and lesbian couples the right to marry.
But our concern is that essentially the legislature has been unwilling to grant gay and lesbian couples the same status as married couples. That doesn't mean that the bill is not a step forward. It's a huge step forward, but nonetheless, the progress is not complete.
Chavone says that's what members of the Traditional Marriage Caucus are afraid of.
A number of other people in the caucus believe it's still too close to marriage. The reason that they're concerned about that is that they think that all it takes is a very minor change and it becomes marriage, and we know that that's the ultimate goal.
No state has legalized homosexual marriage. In 1993, Hawaii came close to it when its Supreme Court first raised the possibility of same-sex marriage. But since then, 30 states have passed preemptive laws saying that they won't recognize such marriages if they are legalized in any other state. Adams says the state's anti-gay marriage amendments are unconstitutional.
The time will certainly come to bring legal challenges to those bills, but before we can get there, we need to first establish the right to marry in some states.
He says that depending on the final language of Vermont's civil unions bill, it may give a gay or lesbian couple legal standing to challenge those laws. More than 70 years before the Civil War was fought, Vermont became the first state to abolish slavery. Gay and lesbian rights advocates are hoping it will be just as much in the vanguard when it comes to legalizing gay marriage. And Lois Farnham says that change can't come soon enough. For the sake of their 19-year-old adopted daughter, Farnham says she and her partner would like to officially tie the knot.
So we could each have a tie legally to the child, but we're missing that bridge in the triangle that we can't be legally tied to each other.
A vote on the civil unions bill is expected later this month. If the bill passes both Vermont's House and Senate, the governor has said he will sign it. I'm Heather Zerlag in Washington.
The Vermont legislature passed the civil unions bill in 2000, and its Marriage Equality Act in 2009 made it the fourth U.S. state to offer full legal marriage rights to same-gender couples. If the state-level dominoes were to begin to fall for marriage equality, Vermont would be one state to watch.
Little wheel, spin and spin, big wheel, turn around, around. Little wheel, spin and spin, big wheel, turn around, around. Little wheel, spin and spin, big wheel, turn around, around.
Thanks for discovering This Way Out, brought to you by the nonprofit Overnight Productions. News Wrap was reported this week by David Hunt and Melanie Keller and produced by Brian DeShazer. Our archival correspondents were Frank Stoltz, Julie Carver, and Heather Zerlock. The Carpenters, Blood, Sweat, and Tears, Sean Chapin, Liza Minnelli, and Buffy St. Marie performed some of the music you heard, and Kim Wilson composed and performed our theme music. This Way Out thanks John Dyer V of Winston, Oregon, and Richard Murtick and Brad Payton of Silicon Valley. Listener donors make this program possible. Ask us about how you can join them. Look for This Way Out Radio on social media, email us at info@thiswayout.org, or write to us at P.O. Box 1065, Los Angeles, California, 90078, USA. For coordinating producer Greg Gordon and all of us at This Way Out, I'm Lucia Chappell. Thanks for listening online at thiswayout.org or wherever you get your podcasts, and on WUMD Dartmouth, Massachusetts, 4BI Fortitude Valley, Queensland, KHOI Ames, Iowa, and a wide array of community terrestrial and internet stations around the world, including...
Hi, this is Ray Lynn, and you're listening to KBOO Portland.